Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. Our guest is Jacqueline Novogratz. She's the CEO of Acumen, a worldwide community of socially and environmentally responsible entrepreneurs and investors. Her new book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, draws on amazing stories from changemakers around the world using the power of the free market to create more sustainable and ethically responsible systems in countries like Uganda, Pakistan, and Colombia, as well as here in the United States, where wealth has become increasingly concentrated in a smaller percentage of the U.S. population. Acumen has helped over 323 million people improve their lives through better healthcare, sanitation, and sustainable, accessible energy. It isn't easy, but Novogratz has a track record that shows it is attainable. She joined us from New York recently, right at the beginning of the unrest in America after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Jacqueline Novogratz, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, and it's good to be here. Acumen is a global organization that invests the right kind of capital into the right kind of character, surrounded by the right community to solve some of our biggest problems of poverty.
And in your book, you have some wonderful examples of all that, and I'd like to get into those later. But before we do, I'd like to just know a little bit about you and how you got started down this path. Because as I understand it, you were really, you know, working in the world of finance big time, like for Chase Bank. Tell us about, you know, growing up, where you grew up, and how you first got interested in these kinds of issues of social responsibility, and just what kind of formed your philosophy.
Thanks. Yeah, so I actually grew up as the eldest of seven in a military kind of Catholic immigrant family, very scrappy, and probably because of both my schooling, my family, a lot of themes of duty and stuff like that in the 1960s and 70s. I always grew up with this sense of wanting to change the world and wanting to be used. So I would say, Matt, that I'm actually an accidental banker. But the thing about being a banker, which was my first job out of college, is that it introduced me not only to 40 countries around the world, but it did so at a time when the world was in turmoil. It was the financial crisis in the early 1980s. And I saw that while I loved the tools of the bank, I loved how numbers could tell a story, I didn't love how low-income people were excluded. And that was the beginning, I would say, of the most important thread of my curiosity, which got me looking at both the vibrancy that I saw in the developing world as well as in the United States amongst low-income communities and how they had no access. And then the story begins. I go to Africa, I start Rwanda's first microfinance bank, and I just keep letting the work teach me what I have to do next until I end up starting Acumen to go big or go home, if you will, and take on issues like electricity for the poor and health for the poor and housing for the poor in ways that actually solve problems.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things I liked about some of your stories about growing up was your dad. There was one episode that, you know, told me a lot about your character and kind of the person you are. I know you grew up kind of shy about talking in public and that kind of thing, and you've had to get good at that over the years. But there was a story about your dad making you do a pull-up contest. Can you tell us that and how that made you feel? Because I thought that was awesome.
I think a lot of other kind of kids of my generation who grew up in big Catholic families might relate. But it was also a very masculine family, and I had four brothers. And my dad is amazing, but... and he definitely thought his kids could do anything. And I was his first daughter. So he was the coach. He was an All-American football player himself. And he coached this inner city team, eighth graders. And I was like 9 years old. They were all playing football. And he brought me to practice one day. And these boys were so much bigger than me. And they were like, "Coach, you got a girl?" And he was like, "I got a girl, and she's as tough as you are." And then he proceeded to invite them into this competition with me on pull-ups, and I wanted to die. But once I was in the game, I was in. And he claims that I beat them all. I remember beating at least a couple of the guys. But it was what I think is so important for little girls now. When you have a sense of your physical power, which we don't do enough in giving to our girls, I think you start to see yourself as a different kind of being in the world. And even though I was, by all objective accounts, kind of little, I didn't see myself that way.
And I thought it was cool that your dad kind of, you know, in a way taught you a lesson by showing you what you could do and with those other guys. So I like that story. Another story that really resonated with me, and I'd like you to talk about what lessons you learned from it. I hope I get this right. You and a friend were at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and you were in college. And there was some kind of thing where, you know, you being in town at the campus, you got some kind of Christmas time project to help people who are needy in the area, people living in poverty, and drop off some, you know, Christmas basket kind of thing to them. And I remember doing something similar to this when I was a kid. My parents would go into a very poor area in the San Joaquin Valley near Bakersfield, which is really literally where the Grapes of Wrath was set. And these people were, you know, not far removed from that in the 1960s. And I remember, you know, at Christmas time going and dropping off, you know, food and some toys and things like that. And, you know, I'm not really fully understanding what was going on as a kid, now looking back on it, thinking, you know, that was pretty neat that my parents did that. But in your case, once you got out there, you started to run into some difficulties. And I was wondering if you could share that story with us.
Sure. Yeah. My roommate and I were bringing these big bags of food and turkey and lots of presents for the kids. And it wasn't very far away from Charlottesville, and suddenly we were truly in another world. And I think the first thing was the power of language, in that we would stop and ask people for directions, and I couldn't understand what their answers were, even though they were speaking English and I was speaking English, and I was wondering if they could really clearly understand me. And that I felt a shame in my inability to really hear. And then finally the guy kept, you know, just kept moving on. And the longer it took us to find this place behind some sign that said Earl's Woodshed, I couldn't help but see the surroundings and how fully disadvantaged this community was, which was right next door. And then I started wondering, like, what am I doing? Like, two privileged co-eds, you know, Lady Bountiful, dropping bags of food, and I have no idea who these kids are. I haven't talked to the parents. I don't even know if the kids believe or not. And so what if they see me and I become Christmas? And so even though we had kind of imagined this great celebration scene, when we got there, I turned to my roommate and said, "Suzanne, I can't do this. Just stop the car and I'm going to run the stuff and run right back and let's go." And we literally looking at this, it almost looked like a sharecropper's shack with a couple of mangy dogs hanging around. And I just took those bags and I ran as fast as I could and I dropped them on the porch and I hightailed it back to the car and we took off. And it was a huge moment in my life because I thought, what would I do now? Like, what if I were talking to that kid now? What would I say to her? Me, the younger me. And I would say, your empathy was great. Your intention was great. But what you were lacking was moral imagination. What you were lacking was to go beyond empathy, because empathy alone just reinforces the status quo. And the next step has to be immersion. Get close, understand the problem from the perspective of the people you want to quote unquote help, which is such a loaded word, to serve, and then figure out the system around it that is keeping people in poverty. And I didn't understand any of that then, but I did understand that this form of helicopter charity, while important in emergencies and in other situations, could even then be done better. But certainly in the way that I did it was deeply lacking. And I think in so many ways that moment set me on the next step of the journey.
Well, it certainly doesn't really help the situation in the long term, which is what it seems to me your life is about now. And I'm glad you answered that question, because I was going to ask you, what would you go back and tell your young self? So thanks for doing that. So you used a term, moral imagination, and that comes up a lot in your book, and I know for acumen. Could you explain to us what that means to you?
Yeah, as I said, moral imagination starts with empathy, but that's almost too simple. I would say, and it's, you know, as we look around the world right now in this moment of crisis, where we have such a lack of moral imagination in our leaders, I would say that the moral imagination insists upon seeing another person in his or her whole humanity. And that means, you know, trying to put yourself into their shoes, which is often impossible to do, but to recognize them as full human beings. You know, so often we go when we want to fix or help or control or make invisible. And so it's convenient, even if we don't want to look at ourselves very harshly in that way, to do that, to see people as good or bad or poor or rich, and that's all they are. But to actually do the work of really trying to see another person, understand their perspective, and not be overwhelmed by how hard things are, still be able to see the world you want to create, and then do all the work that's needed to get from the reality of the situation that person is in, and the system that has put that person there is in, and then have the drive to go and see what could be anyway. And that can be applied to a person, a family, a community, an organization, even a nation.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of the parable of, you know, if you give someone fish, they can, you know, eat that, but if you teach them how to fish, they can feed themselves. And it seems to me that that's kind of, you know, one of the principles behind this.
It is one of the principles behind this. You know, I would take it even further and say, you know, having worked on many fishing communities, most people know how to fish. What they lack is access to fair markets so that they can sell that fish, so that that fish can stay cold, so that their seas aren't being overfished by others. That actually having the real moral imagination is a lot more nuanced and a lot more complex. And if we want to solve the big problems that we have right now, where our systems are so clearly broken, we've got to be willing to go to that next place. This isn't a moment for silver bullets or linear fixes, because that kind of gets us where we are. The reason that, you know, I wrote this book and focusing on a moral revolution is that we need to bring that moral imagination into every system.
Well, let's talk about some examples of this that you've been involved with, because they're amazing stories. And it kind of, it starts out to me right after 9/11, you decide to reach out into the Muslim world and you go to Pakistan. Tell us about some of the projects you got involved with and some of the wonderful things that are going on there. Just pick maybe one or two examples.
All right. And thank you for asking about Pakistan and 9/11. I actually think, again, you know, looking back at my younger self, I do think that that was a real act of moral imagination, in that I had not ever been to Pakistan. I knew after 9/11, I had a fledgling organization. I knew that the key somewhere to the future had to be in understanding the Muslim world, and there was no way to understand it than to go and work with and in it. And so 9/11 comes, decide that we're going to go and work there. And on my first day in January 2002, I opened the newspaper and saw the beheading of an American journalist named Daniel Pearl from the Wall Street Journal. And I thought, oh my goodness, where am I? But the moral imagination doesn't stop there, right? It recognizes that we have so many different stories. And then I was really lucky to meet someone named Said Barbarelli, an older man who's now just turned 92. I was asking him about his country and what could I do? And he said, look, we've seen people like you come and go forever. My advice to you would be come, stay, do the work. Don't brag about it until you've actually done something. And man, was that good advice. And so I began to meet extraordinary people. I began to see the other stories of Pakistan, the generosity, the warmth, the deeply ambitious, upwardly mobile population, including the very poor, how similar my own Catholic upbringing was to so many of these big Muslim families' culture. And so I started to meet incredible entrepreneurs. One was a young guy named Javad Aslam, who was actually born in Baltimore, had worked in commercial real estate, but after 9/11 decided to go back to his parents' homeland and see what he could do to bring the skills of housing there. And it was a long story where Acumen invests patient capital, right? We invest for 10 to 15 years with those entrepreneurs who are willing to immerse and work with the poor and build solutions that enable the poor to access services like affordable housing in ways that they can't only afford, but that they value. And so he built a system where he put all the rules of the housing development on the outside of the houses so that people would have a clear and transparent understanding of how housing worked. And he really focused on building community, not just housing. And one of the things that he decided to do was to ensure that this was a very diverse community, because this was also a time in Pakistan, like in the United States, where even subgroups of groups were all dividing according to identity. And so it was a small community, but as I said, very diverse. And there was really only room for one mosque. Now, many of the people who had come from other communities were used to having their own prayer services, even in houses, even small ones. And so Javad thought, that's too much of a focus on an individual. We need to balance it with what it means to build a real community. And so he pretty much fought and cajoled and seduced and did whatever he needed to do to bring the community together to figure out how would they balance the tension between individual desires and what it means to belong to something, given that all of these different sects or subgroups of Islam had so much in common. And they ultimately did decide that they would elect one of their religious leaders, one imam, who would say the Friday prayers, and the whole community would pray together across Shia, Sunni, and all the different subgroups of Sunni Islam. And when I would tell that story in Pakistan, people would cry, because they would say, you know, we remember 40, 50 years back when people did that, and what happened that we got so fractured. And I think that there's real truth in that for all of our countries. Just to say that the skills of building like this may take longer, but they're more enduring, and they're also fiscally sound. And so over time, Javad, who built a house for himself in the middle of this affordable, low-income community so that he could truly immerse, ended up becoming the first affordable, Sharia-compliant or Islamic-compliant mortgage program in the country. It became a model. He ended up selling his company a portion of his company for $35 million. And he's replicating it across the country now. And he sits on the Prime Minister's Housing Commission to look at what it would actually take to bring affordable housing to millions of people. And that's the power of the moral imagination combined with the right kind of capital. It just doesn't happen magically.
We're going to take a short break. Our guest is Jacqueline Novogratz, CEO of Acumen, a worldwide organization of entrepreneurs and investors looking to make a more economically and environmentally sustainable world. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with Jacqueline Novogratz. She's the CEO of Acumen and the author of the new book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, that profiles people around the world using market solutions to health, sanitation, and energy problems confronted by some of the poorest populations on the planet. One of the things that struck me is how this is not about, you know, being a charity. This is not about just providing seed funds. You're really using the power of markets to improve people's lives and put it to work for them, for the 99%, if you will, instead of the 1%. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. And it's actually really for the people who make $2, $3, and $4 a day internationally and in the United States who are living in poverty. And so it's flipping the traditional model of capitalism that we all, that I grew up with, where everything focused on making a few shareholders wealthy, to one who takes seriously what it would take to build an inclusive system that could financially sustain itself over time, but insists on including the vulnerable, insists on including the poor. And what's been so fascinating, and I love that you talked about it, it doesn't happen overnight. It's not a 3-year internship. This is 10 to 20 years of hard, gritty work. But if you do it right and you hold that tension of inclusivity and financial sustainability, we can create models that can really make change. And what's so both frustrating and hopeful about this current moment when we're all shouting at each other is that there are entrepreneurs, including in the United States, that are really just so impressive in that they move beyond ideology. They're looking at solving problems. Because what I see too much around me is a whole generation that has fully given up on capitalism and would rather just destroy the system. But I think, well, what will we replace? We don't know what to replace the system with yet. And so rather than go full hog into everything now is decided for you by the government, because I've lived in those systems, and that takes away all the individual freedom that capitalism does provide. And so rather than going to the other pole, is there a place in the middle where we can learn to use the tools of capital in a way that redefines success based not on how the wealthy are treated, although that matters too, but specifically on how the poor and the vulnerable are included. And after, you know, we've helped build over 100 companies, 130 companies today, and have seen them serve 300 million of the world's low-income people, I know it's possible. It's just not enough. We got 8 billion of us, and so we have work to do.
And, you know, one of the things I thought about before the last couple of weeks, you know, with the pandemic and everything going on, with climate change as being this huge existential threat that's still could make this pandemic seem like nothing if we do nothing about it. It's a looming threat. Is that a lot of these ideas that you have of using the market to create sustainable communities and people's lives that have more value and valuing, you know, every human life, is that this has good consequences, better outcomes for the environment, particularly the climate. Could you talk about some of the projects you've been involved with that, you know, reduce, you know, our carbon emissions and make for more sustainable communities?
Yeah, and to be honest with you, when we started, I didn't even really understand the climate consequences as much. But in 2007, 1.5 billion people in the world lacked all access to electricity. 1.5 billion, 130 years after Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. And that's a situation that is not just unproductive and unjust, but it's immoral. And, you know, we ask why. And this is why I love these entrepreneurs who ask, well, why not? Because the why is we have the skills, we have the tools, we have the knowledge, we lack the imagination, and importantly, we lack the will, because it's really hard to figure out how to build systems, particularly when you've got a status quo that's dependent on kerosene, which is how Americans lit their homes in the 19th century, those old hurricane lamps. And so same, across the continent of Africa, people would buy tiny bits of kerosene every day for about 50 cents a day. The good thing about it is if you can't afford it that day, you go without light. You just have a night in fully in the dark, but it's dirty, it's expensive, it throws off hundreds of millions of tons of carbon every year. And so these two young guys with a $30 solar lantern came to our offices and said, you know, we want to eradicate kerosene from the earth. They'd never built a business. But that what they had done is immerse. Sam Goldman, one of the co-founders, had spent 5 years in an unelectrified village in West Africa. And they seemed to have the character and the grit and the willingness to listen to low-income people and understand their perspective. And so we took a bet on them. We're still partially invested 13 years later, but we started at the prototype stage. And over time, I really started to understand that, again, these simple answers, that our patient capital, which in the early stages is backed by philanthropy, it didn't matter how patient our capital was. Without helping them with the kind of talent that they needed, they couldn't put it to use. And without extending what I would call our social capital or our access to corporations that had supply chains that could help them distribute, design companies that could help them design the light so that it was even more affordable for people who made $1 a day, philanthropists, because they actually needed grant money to start building markets that had never existed before. We ended up putting about $5 million of philanthropic back capital. And then another $6 million out of one of the three for-profit impact funds that Acumen also runs or manages. And just a few months ago, they announced that they brought light and electricity to over 100 million low-income people. And what that means is not only, and most importantly, the dignity of being able to flip on a switch and having a light turn on, but without kerosene, you're taking a fundamental cut at the 36% of respiratory illness, mostly suffered by women and children, that kerosene is responsible for. You've cut the filth in their homes. You've cut the carbon emissions. You've improved children's educational opportunities, and you've improved income. And so that's a pretty good return on your investment. If you had only felt sorry for people, and like me in college, if you had only used your philanthropy to give everybody a light that first $250,000 would have gotten, you know, about 10,000 people light. Good. We would have all felt amazing about ourselves. And then we would have gone home. But by putting that to work so that we could immerse, so that we could understand how the poor made decisions, so that we could help these companies build systems, this company D-Light has lit the world.
Yeah, and wasn't the other partner is Ned Tozen from Stanford?
Ned Tozen. They both went to Stanford. They met in a class called Design for Extreme Affordability.
Yeah, it's just this amazing story. And I think it's them, I'm hoping I'm remembering this right, that they go to one of their customers, one of the people that has one of their lights, a woman who uses it, and ask her, you know, how would you make this better? And she
was actually me, Matt. I was the one that went there. I brought this guy.
Tell us about that.
It was an amazing moment. And it was an amazing moment for me, too, because, you know, when I started Acumen, I had spent so many years seeing really well-intended people go to the organizations they supported with their philanthropy and have low-income women's groups particularly, you know, tell them how amazing they were, sometimes do a dance, and they always made me feel uncomfortable. But everybody would feel really good somehow. And so here I was with a woman named Teresia. She was a tiny, tiny grandmother and her little grandchild at her hut in the middle of the day. It was like midnight, only one little window. And I was with David Small, who was this enormous guy with this white shock of hair from Australia. He was the regional distributor in Nairobi. And so we go to see the D-Light light in action. And we sit down and I'm talking to Teresia, and all of a sudden it hits me, because I know D-Light's so good at listening to their customers. And I say, Teresia, do me a favor, tell Mr. Small what you like about the light. And she standing there and she tells him all the things that I just told you. And then I said, now tell him, if you would, if you have any suggestions for how you might improve the light. And number one, I thought the question might stymie her, or she'd give us a fairly pablum response, but not this woman. Puts her hand on her hip, cocks her head to the side and says, well, first, you know, it's great that I can put this light in the sun and it charges it. But if I could charge my cell phone at the same time, it would be really good, because I would have a cell phone and I could make money charging other people's cell phones. Boom. And I say, amazing, thinking she's done. And then she puts her hand up and she says, and second, and I was like, no, that's enough. Just like, no, second. And she's, you know, if I had a string from the ceiling, it would be easier for me to put it up and then I'd have more light. And she goes through four different modifications that she'd like to see. And he in turn listens in a way that I hadn't seen enough of in my life. And suddenly it's clear to me that she is neither pandering nor begging. And he is not standing there with the arrogant certainty of so many of us that think we know the answers, but he's trying to earn her trust. And in this interaction are the seeds of their individual transformation. And that is when it really hit me that this isn't about Teresia's dignity. This is about our collective dignity.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Jacqueline Novogratz, CEO of a global umbrella of entrepreneurs and investors out to make a more sustainable and moral system for some of the world's most vulnerable populations. She tells us how this is being done by people in countries like Uganda, Colombia, and Pakistan, as well as here in the U.S. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Thank you. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our interview with Jacqueline Novogratz. Her new book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, profiles real stories of how entrepreneurs and investors around the world are trying to retool systems into ones that are more fair, just, and economically as well as environmentally sustainable.
When I titled this book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, you can imagine my publisher kind of took a breath in the word that worried the publisher and others was the word moral, because it's become a hot button for so many of us who see moral defined as my righteousness over your righteousness, rather than this understanding that we are at a moment in our history of interdependence where we have to have the courage to navigate between not only different belief systems, but between different truths, different values. And the moral is that willingness to put our shared humanity at the center and sometimes have to make ugly decisions, but make principled decisions anyway with a commitment to making those decisions the best they can be once we've made them. And that, there's nobody like Andrew Otieno who embodies that courage to me. If I brought Andrew physically to meet you, he might not look like this, what you're going to hear in this story in your imagination, because he's kind of gentle looking, wears wire rim glasses. You could almost see him as an accountant or doctor. And indeed, he's a health clinic worker. He grew up in a slum. He runs a health clinic. And he worked for an organization called Jami Bora, which was a micro-lending organization that had its office right on the side of one of the largest open-air markets in a slum of Nairobi, Kibera slum, which is one of the largest slums in Africa and in the world. And if you've never been in an open-air market, picture lots of open stalls with people selling fruits and vegetables and secondhand clothing and everything under the sun. Very, very vibrant. And about 80,000 people depended on this market for their economic lifeline, their very livelihood. So in 2007, 2008, there was a very contentious election in Kenya. It caused horrendous riots in the name of tribe, and identity came right to the surface. There was a group of about 200 young men who felt from historic fact and understanding and misunderstanding that the land beneath the toy market was technically theirs. And so, having no language, having no way or language that would be heard by others or a way of going through some process, they erupted into violence. And one night they burned down the whole market. Within days, as in like 48 hours, they were starting to claim the territory and put down wooden stakes where they intended to build their 200 houses. And Andrew, having no other leaders that stepped up, decided to step up. And you, again, have to imagine there's no police coming. There are no nonprofits. They've all left. It's too scary. The riots are still going on. The fires are still burning. And so Andrew started negotiating with the young men. And it wasn't pretty, because he couldn't figure out how does he get this market built with no outside help, no real security that anybody can trust. And he decides that the only option that he has is to hire the young men to build the market. And more than that is that he decides, not by himself, but with a multi-tribal council that he becomes part of, that he convinces this council to allow the new market, once it's rebuilt, to include 200 stalls, one for each of the young men. It's a very radical move. Meanwhile, he uses a social capital, a woman named Ingrid Monroe, a Swedish woman who had made her life in Kenya, to raise the millions of dollars that were needed to get this thing rebuilt. But Andrew knew they couldn't wait for, you know, due process and everything else that was going to happen, because people would starve if the market wasn't built. And I was there while the riots were still going on, and was in that market and saw the stakes and knew that he was holding an incredibly burdensome, terrible decision that kept me up all night, swirling through the ethics of, well, are these kids being rewarded? And ultimately, he and I talked the whole thing out. And he said, look, everyone here, when you don't have systems that support you, everyone here is ready and willing to give up something for the community, for peace. And the market people have to live with these young hoodlums now in the market. The young men will have to give up their dreams of building houses and learn how to work at their stalls. I will accompany them, and we will get this built. And sure enough, they did. I was back 3 months later, and that market looked better than it ever looked. It's possible to rebuild. And it's been 12 years since I was in that market when it was burned to the ground. Andrew has accompanied the young men. One of them has become a priest. Another one has built football teams. Are they all perfect? No. Have some of them let down the community and let down the young men? Definitely. A minority. My world and our world does not always have happy endings. Life is messy. And when I look at what's happening in America and around the world today, but let me speak for a moment about America, where Acumen has 30 companies. And I see all these young people of every race and orientation walking peacefully in the streets saying, we're hurt, we're scared, we feel betrayed, we have no voice. I think, what is beneath those words? And what worries me about too many of our storytellers is we're only focused on that small group that doesn't have the language and doesn't feel heard. And some of them are just kind of bad eggs. And goodness knows whether there's truth and who's being hired and outside, you know, all that other stuff. That's a sideshow. We've got to handle that violence and that outrage. The real show here is that we have a broken criminal justice system. We have racism we have not confronted. We have an unequal world that COVID has exposed, where so many of our citizens who are people of color, who are poor, are wildly disproportionately impacted. And that is not just a wake-up call. That is an alarm. The good news is I am seeing people across this country and across the world who will not buy into these trite assumptions, these divisions, this cynicism, but are getting on with the work of getting on. And they are building companies that do put the poor first, that are beyond ideology, that recognize we need the private sector and the government and civil society. And this is the future. Now we just have to build it.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded this last week with so many events of a year that was pivotal in my childhood, 1968, which was just a terrible year. The assassination of Martin Luther King, followed by the assassination of Robert Kennedy, riots throughout the world and in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. The Vietnam War was raging. The light at the end of the tunnel turned out to be a train in that case with the Tet Offensive. It was just a brutal year. And then at the very end of it was this incredible mission to the moon, where Apollo 8 went around the moon at Christmas and took that famous photograph called Earthrise, and which really began and kicked off the environmental movement. And you know, when you talk to the astronauts, whether they've flown to the moon or just on the space station, I shouldn't say just, if they've flown on the space station, they all kind of say the same thing, that when they're up there, perhaps with their, you know, with, it's an international space station, they're up there with Russian or Japanese or whoever, you know, people from other countries. And they say, you know, we get together for dinner and we fly over each other's countries and towns and we eat with each other and we look down and we see no borders. We just see an Earth and it's very fragile. And, you know, they all come back with a very changed perspective. And I'm, when I listen to you and I read your book, I'm reminded of the words of Robert Kennedy and the words that his brother spoke in, at his funeral. And he was quoting George Bernard Shaw when he said, "Some people see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and ask, why not?" And it seems to me that your life is about that.
Yeah. I do believe that each one of us has infinite possibility within ourselves. And we're on this earth for such a short time. Why aren't we doing more to live into that and help other people live into their light? You know, it's funny that you speak about that mission. One of the great joys in my life was an astronaut named Ron Garing, who I met him in the most amazing way. He actually emailed me from the space station and said, you know, I went to, this sounds like I'm bragging, but there's a point of this story, but he said, I went to the space station and I only took two books. Dr. Muhammad Yunus's book. Dr. Yunus was the founder of the Grameen Bank and got the Nobel Prize for his work in microfinance, and your book. And I was blown away by that. And he said the same thing. He said, you know, I look at this earth as a fragile oasis, and why can't they see it? And we got to be friends. And so I actually did an event in our offices, which is in Nairobi, but right near the Kibera slum. And I had all the young guys from the slum, not the kids, although I know some of them who burned down the market, but other young men. And Ron was on another mission, and we were able to have him wired into the room to speak to all of these young men, many of whom were born, raised, still lived and worked in Nairobi slums, talking to a guy orbiting the earth. And if we can do that, I'm sorry, we can figure out a way to get electricity to everyone. If we can get healthcare in America to everyone, we can certainly start to see each other for our true humanity and not be bogged down by all these silly facades that are, at the end of the day, meaningless. But to do that requires more than systems. And this goes back again to where I worry that we're having the wrong conversations today. Because even if we got healthcare to all Americans, and I am someone who absolutely believes that we wouldn't be solving the health problem. Our systems are too entwined. We've got a broken education system and a criminal justice system and a food system. And so we have work to do on all of those systems. And so it's too easy to say, you know, just to man this one change. This is where I would make a plea for nuance, that we need more entrepreneurial leaders of all stripes. It doesn't matter if you're an entrepreneur that wants to bring electricity to the world. Those are big stories. This is a moment for small stories too, where each and every one of us can do more to listen. Each and every one of us could think about, how do we partner with someone who is seemingly on the other side, or if I'm in the private sector where government could extend my services. There's an entrepreneur named Sam Polk in the United States, and he's not in the book, but He'll be in the next one, I'm betting. He was a Wall Streeter. He was really concerned with food deserts in the U.S. And food deserts are in the inner cities, places where you can't get any healthy food. And any food that you do buy is really expensive. And so he first started a nonprofit and thought it was great because he could really immerse and understand people's needs. But he saw what they really needed was easy, accessible, affordable food. And so he created a nutritious, affordable fast food restaurant called Every Table. And we thought he might need a second set of restaurants in more affluent neighborhoods to subsidize what it would cost him to build this in LA, Southern LA. But the community so appreciated the opportunity to have access to this fresh, healthy, affordable food that they quickly were able to provide enough sales to the company that they grew to 8 restaurants. So on the first day of lockdown in LA, Sam stepped back. What's his North Star? You know, his number one priority was not making profit, even though he's a profitable company. His North Star is to get food, healthy food to people who need it. Then when Governor Newsom in California created a partnership between a hotel chain and homeless people, they then also partnered with Every Table. And then other elderly homes came in. More philanthropy started supporting them. And right now they're running at a pace where they're delivering about 150,000 meals a day. And that also gives me hope, even though this is an anguishing time.
Well, on that hopeful note, we're out of time. I so appreciate you spending your time with us today, and good luck with your work, especially and your book. I enjoyed reading it and learning about what you do, and I think it's so important. So I just want to say, keep up the good work, and you're a hero to me.
Babe, thank you so, so much for this conversation and for your curiosity and the way that you listen. It means a lot.
Thanks again to our guest, Jacqueline Novogratz, CEO of Acumen and the author of the new book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, published by Henry Holt and Company and available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share this one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.